Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. The topic today, the nature of power and influence and its tendency towards abuse. Our two panelists include, first, Chris Hedges from Princeton, New Jersey. He is one of our nation's most insightful cultural critics, social and political activists, and authors. For almost 20 years, he was a foreign correspondent in war zones and conflicts in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans. Having reported for the New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, and other news outlets, while at the Times he received the Pulitzer Prize for reporting on global terrorism. The same year he received Amnesty International's Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. Over the years he has taught at Columbia, Princeton, New York University, and University of Toronto. Among Chris's many noteworthy books, his latest is Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, a hard, compelling look at the most impoverished regions in the United States that have become what Chris calls sacrifice zones for the benefit of the powerful and the wealthy. His weekly columns can be read every Monday at truthdig.com. In the second part of our program, Chris will be joined by Joshim Hagopian. He is a practicing clinical psychologist and counselor practicing in California for over a quarter of a century, with an emphasis upon disadvantaged youth, family abuse, the child welfare system, and education. He attended the U.S. Military Academy at West Point through a congressional appointment in the 1960s, but he clashed with the system. He was railroaded out at the end of his third year. This resulted in him filing charges against the Academy for failure to allow due process, and he won the case in New York Federal District Court. This case set the precedent that continues today for cadets to have the right to present their case with witnesses before the Academy. His story is retold in his manuscript book, Don't Let the Bastards Get You Down. His writings focus on education, geopolitics, the national security and police states, international relations for global research, many of which have been featured on the Public Radio Network and Boiling Frogs. His articles can be found at globalresearch.com, and his West Point book is available at redredsea.net. We're beginning with Chris. Nice to have you with us today, Chris.
Thank you, Gary.
Since the dawn of settled human societies and when they became hierarchically structured and based upon social levels to establish order and demand conformity to that order, power, privilege, and influence have wielded strong emphasis to those who were smart enough or powerful enough to create an authoritarian class, and everyone else was considered disadvantaged. Today we discover power and influence being abused in almost every area of our life. Almost every social order, whether it's government, corporations, the legal system, law enforcement, education, mainstream media, healthcare, they all, at some level, have abused that power or continue to do so. But what they have in common is a tier of authority that abides by a set of conventional values that are rigid, unchanging, and when they say it's the final word, they want it to be the final word. They do not tolerate dissent. Deviation from convention is regarded as defiance. For example, whistleblowing lies outside of conventional authority, and therefore we find whistleblowers, all of them, ostracized and persecuted. In my own primary line of research and clinical practice, which is healthcare, families are put into a position where if they at all challenge anything within the orthodox medical dominant theory, they are frequently put into harm's way. Many families now face the reality of having their children taken away if they're not vaccinated. And just today, a family of foster parents had their adopted child, who is only about a few months old, taken from them by child services because the mother, educated about the dangers of vaccines at such a young age, refused to submit her infant to the flu vaccine. Now, this is exactly the kind of actions we would expect from a totalitarian or fascistic state. This is the way totalitarian governs over a population by erasing freedom of thought and expression and sustaining a rigid convention that it uses force to maintain. It has institutionalized intolerance of the other. Chris, you have been going up against these powers of intolerance and authority for many decades. I'd like you to take your time and share what you have observed and personally experienced as being the fundamental dynamics of how authoritarian power operates, and how does the darker side of power lead to the abuse of this power and influence without any remorse. The forum is yours.
Well, the problem occurs when you have a tiny oligarchic elite that cannot be challenged anymore, where power becomes completely centralized into a very small cobble. That, of course, would typify fascism, communism, and is evidenced in our own corporate system, where a global oligarchic corporate elite has seized all of the levers of power, the mass media, the judicial branch, the legislative branch, and the executive branch. And at that point, your political system seizes up. It ossifies. It becomes impossible for the citizen to carry out incremental or piecemeal reform, which is what a capitalist democracy is designed to do. Government is no longer responsive to the citizen because it is completely captive to that oligarchic elite, in our case, corporate power. Now, I'm a great admirer of Sheldon Wolin's work, Democracy Incorporated, and I think it is an extremely important book, because while he certainly believes that we live in a totalitarian society, a system he calls inverted totalitarianism, it is different from both communism and fascism, in that economics trumps politics. It's all about profit. That wasn't true, for instance, in both communism and fascism. Ideology often trumped economics. For instance, at the end of the war, in World War II, the Nazis, who were being beaten back by the Russian forces, were still expending tremendous energy shipping Jews and others to death camps on the railway lines. It made no economic sense, since war materials were at a premium. That doesn't happen in a system of what Wolin calls inverted totalitarianism. Everything is squeezed for profit. I think it's something you've spoken about quite a bit. The medical profession has become an example of that. The whole for-profit healthcare system is an obscenity. It's far more expensive than our healthcare system than what is provided in other industrialized nations. But because, you know, everything has become, human beings become a commodity, illnesses become a way to make money. So all across the economic spectrum, the political spectrum, we see, the commodification of every aspect of society, including, of course, the ecosystem itself as it is being degraded and destroyed in the name of profit. Now, none of this contributes to the common good. None of this, helps us sustain ourselves as a species or the planet for future generations. It serves the extremely narrow interests of a tiny oligarchic elite that has become completely predatory in every aspect of our lives. and we no longer have any mechanism by which to thwart that, you know, rapacious wringing out of profit of every aspect of our lives. And I, you know, wrote a piece a week or two ago called "The Prison State of America," just to give an example, where now within our prison system, and we have 2.3 million people incarcerated. That's 25% of the world's prison population, although we are only 5% of the world's population. And corporations have moved into these prisons. They control the commissaries, and they have, you know, because they have a captive market, driven prices up by over 100%. Remember, prisoners make $1.30 a day. That's for 8 hours of work. $1.30, $28 a month. We have seen states not only remove items, including shoes, that prisoners used to be provided for when they were incarcerated. So now they have to buy $45 Reeboks if they want money transferred through a private account, through JPay. There are surcharges that they or their families have to pay of up to 40%. Phone rates are 15 cents a minute. Of course, the fines are that are levied upon people who go into prison are thousands of dollars, which they, and people are going broke in prison, so they have to do prison loans. They're finishing prison, thousands of dollars in debt, which if they can't pay back, they go back in. And on top of this kind of predatory squeezing of both prisoners and their families, we are seeing larger and larger numbers of corporations themselves moving into the prison system to take advantage of this cheap labor. And the list of prisons is quite, of companies that have gone into prisons is quite disturbing. And I think that that kind of example is important because it's a window into the world that these corporations would like to create outside these walls. The kind of prison state of America is the perfect dystopian. We now see prison administrators across this country lobbying corporations that have sweatshops overseas to come back to the United States and take advantage of captive labor, which always shows up on time. There's no union organizing. If any worker attempts to protest the working conditions or the wages, they're put in isolation. And so in the last few years, we've watched major corporations, including Bank of America, IBM, Starbucks, Nintendo, JCPenney, Sears, Walmart, Kmart, Procter & Gamble, Johnson & Johnson, Fruit of the Loom, even Caterpillar, Sara Lee, Quaker Oats, Texas Instruments, Hewlett-Packard, Revlon, Macy's, Target, they're all using prison labor. And I think that you have to look at what's happening to the most vulnerable within the society, which is what Joe Sacco and I did in our book Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. We went to these places where there were no checks on predatory capitalism. I know something you also looked at in your film on poverty, because that's going to be replicated now within the wider society.
There's an old English proverb, "He who despises his own life is soon master of another's." And I have counseled a lot of people in my professional career, and a lot of them, not the majority, a minority, have been very wealthy, successful people, and they all had something in common. And that was their need for power and their need to let everyone else know that they were still powerful. And when I asked one of the individuals who was suffering from a debilitating condition that no one knew about, and I said, "Why are you so secret about this?" And he said, "Let me explain something to you." He said, "I am one of the great white sharks, and we're all swimming together looking for a nosebleed." And he said, "The moment someone realizes that I have a disadvantage, it will be exploited. And as a result, I don't let anyone, not even my own wife, know my problem." And I said, okay, fine. I've never broken a confidence. No one will know that you were here. No one will know any of this. And I said, but I'm curious about a couple of things. And he said, what? I said, well, why is it that when people become successful, they always want to be with other successful people, whether it's Aspen or Vail or Palm Beach or Palm Springs or east end of Long Island. And not only do they want to be with those people, but they don't want to be around people they grew up with. They don't want to be reminded. They don't want to eat at the restaurants, or they don't want their kids going to the schools where they grew up. Why is this? What is it that draws people who have power, in whatever form that power manifests, to be around other people? And he gave me his explanation, but I'd like to ask you, why do you feel that this is the case, where we see it all the time at Davos and other places? Only those people who are considered powerful, not just having money, not just having fame, not just being a celebrity, but they have to have power. They have to be able to be a policymaker who can cause change. And we see them all the time together. Why?
Well, it's the same reason addicts stay together. Power is a drug. It's, you know, the more you amass, the more you can manipulate, use, abuse, dispose of anyone around you. That is the characteristic of the powerful. And it was one that I got to see up close. At the age of 10, I went as a scholarship student to a very elite New England boarding school, and I was among the sons of the super rich. And it is a disturbing, peculiar, and even frightening pathology. You know, the rich, you know, there's that famous line that between Fitzgerald and Hemingway where Fitzgerald supposedly says the rich are different than you and I, and Hemingway says something like they have more money. It didn't actually happen, but it did illustrate a reality that Fitzgerald understood and that Hemingway did not. And I think Fitzgerald kind of captured the pathology of the rich in Gatsby, and you know I think the characteristic that one understands of the rich is that, you know, everyone around them is disposable, and whatever kind of mess they create in life, there's always somebody to clean it up. And I think that that's why the rich tend to gravitate towards each other, because they are infected with, you know, the same disease. And I think if you look at the Clintons, there's a kind of classic example of what happens when you spend your life attempting to amass power, how utterly destructive it is towards your soul. I mean, and your conscience. And how, you know, once you attain power, in the same way that this often happens, once you attain wealth, you become obsessed by just kind of, you know, amassing more and more and more.
In the film Poverty Inc., which we appreciate that you contributed your time to, there was the person that was the real Wolf of Wall Street.
Right.
And we filmed him for a couple of hours. And what I found remarkable in his discussion was that there was a time when he was making tens of millions of dollars a year, had a huge yacht, but found out that someone else had a yacht with a helicopter pad on it, and then got depressed.
Right.
And didn't want to go out on his yacht. He had a big mansion out Long Island, found out someone else had a bigger mansion. And he said that once you reach a certain level of wealth and power, then you become obsessed with making sure everyone knows, even if you never go on the boat, that you have the boat, or you could afford the boat, or never fly in the airplane, that you have it. And he said that he was a miserable, lonely person who used drugs because of his misery. But he said every single person that came to work with him which were thousands, and all the other people he met on Wall Street, even though they were not all as debaucherous as him, were still based upon greed and insecurity. Your thoughts upon the people that we give the most attention to and the most control over our lives, the politicians, the policymakers, members of the Supreme Court, the people in the media, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly. We give these people power to make choices for us, to guide us, to tell us what the truth is from their perspective without asking, are these a spiritually aligned people? Are these people doing something selflessly? Your thoughts?
Well, you know, they're very good about presenting a kind of public face or public persona, which is extremely different from the reality. And that was something that I saw as a boy when I would go to the homes of the ultra-rich and watch classmates of mine who were, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, children, kind of callously order around their chauffeurs, their cooks, their servants, their nannies. I also watched that every time any of them got into trouble, there were kind of legions of lawyers and publicists and political personages and judges recruited to protect them. And that's kind of the example of George W. Bush's life, this kind of insidious affirmative action for the rich. And I also saw this very snobbish disdain for not only the poor, but the middle class, although that's very well disguised through acts of philanthropy. But really to the rich, all the lower classes, including the middle class, are viewed as parasites, annoyances that have to be endured and sometimes placated, but should always be controlled. And I think, you know, that strange experience I had as a boy who didn't have money but was able to be on the inside led, you know, very early in my life to this kind of deep hatred of authority and a kind of loathing for the pretensions and the heartlessness and the entitlement that comes with privilege. And I think part of our problem is that, you know, in the public relations industry has been kind of essential in masking this reality, is that we don't understand the pathology of these oligarchic elites.
I want to build on that for a moment. I was friends with one of the founders of the National Cancer Institute, Dr. Dean Burke. And when I had published a series of articles on the politics of cancer back in the early 1970s, Burke read them, and we had a meeting. I'd never met the man. And he said, "Do you really want to know the part of the story that you don't know exists, that no one knows exists?" I said, "Yeah." So he introduces me to the most powerful person in the United States as far as cancer went, and in the national government. And we had a very candid conversation, but it was he would not allow me to reveal his name, so I didn't. But here's what he said. He said, "You were talking about Dr. Linus Pauling, and how Pauling had made important research on vitamin C and cancer. In fact, I introduced Pauling to Albert St. George, who discovered ascorbic acid and won the Nobel Prize for it. And Pauling was the only American to ever win two unshared Nobel Prizes, one in chemistry and one in peace. And Pauling was talking about how people should be having about 20,000 milligrams of vitamin C a day, but therapeutically you could use it for cancer, and he was doing research. And he said, this will never happen. And I said, why? He said, well, because, and at that point he opened up a folder, and he said, look at all the results of all these naturally occurring foods and herbs like curcumin from turmeric and green tea. He said, we've known for a long time that these can help prevent cancer or can help in the lessening the stages of cancer. If you take these things, we've known this. We've done the research here. But we have to go through the President's National Cancer Advisory Board, and these are the most powerful titans in America, including one of them was Benno Schmidt, who ran a major corporation, pharmaceutical corporation. And he said, They're the ones who decide what gets done. He said, you will never see a natural treatment for any disease that is supported by or sponsored by the United States government, even if we do the research proving that it works. They won't allow that. So then I had a conversation with Pauling, because every time Pauling came to New York, or at least many times when he came to New York, he'd come by the Institute of Applied Biology, where I was a research fellow and for 31 years, and I was doing research on anti-aging. And we'd chat, we'd have long conversations. And I brought this to his attention. And he said, well, he said, he is right. He said, Gary, he said, I published over 400 papers, and yet I'm warned constantly by colleagues and other scientists, stay away from vitamin C. You know, it's kryptonite. You'll destroy your reputation. And you think, how can you destroy your reputation if you're doing good science that could save lives, prevent disease, that's inexpensive, easily accessible? How could that cause a life to be destroyed? And he said, I'd already been down this path when I was against nuclear arms and with Sakharov and others tried to get the armaments treaty. And he said, but I have seen more hatred, loathing, and politics against me because of my support of vitamin C than anything I've ever done in my career. He said, this man is correct. You will never see any natural nutrient advocated for. So in this context, I'm sure that many people, if not the majority, in our professions, including politics, with a more or less honest motivation going in to do good. And I believe many people feel that they have something positive to contribute. And you talk with graduate students, a lot of them want to bring their idealism and integrity into a corrupt system. And then they get in there, and when they start seeing what they have to do to either survive or climb through the ranks and reach a status of power and influence, more often than not, their judgment is clouded, or even worse, they're corrupted by the power and status that they have acquired. And there's all these handmaidens of industry, the lobbyists, the consultants who are willing to put money in your pocket, give you advancements. And Pauling said no, he didn't need any of that. Others have said no, and they've been ostracized. And the people that end up in power telling us what to do, what to eat, what to drink, what's safe, what's not safe, almost to a person, have been corrupted. Your thoughts, please.
Well, it's careerism. And, most people, even people with good intentions, become victims of it. And people will do horrible things to advance within any system, even evil things. When there's a great memoir of the Holocaust written by an Austrian doctor. It's called Prisoners of Fear. And she ends up in Auschwitz. Her name is Ella Lingensreiner, because she was sheltering Jews and helping them escape. And she said that, most people, she worked with Mengele. And she said Mengele didn't believe any of the Nazi ideology. It was all about building his career. She said for the guards, it was all about looting, what was on the transports that came with those Jews that were exterminated. It's reduced to kind of its basest instinct, and I think that in the age of modern massive bureaucracies, and we've seen this through psychological studies, people will jettison any kind of moral independence to advance themselves. And that was true when Gita Sereny interviewed the former commander of Sobibor, and again boiled it down. He had been a kind of provincial policeman, and becoming an SS camp guard was a way to achieve a certain status within the bureaucratic structure. So I think that, yeah, history has shown that once people buy into a system, even a system as evil as mass extermination, careerism is a powerful motivating factor that obliterates conscience. And you know, I think you see that within the corporate state itself. We have built this vast system of internal surveillance where, you know, people spend all day long spying on fellow citizens, and not citizens who have ever committed a crime or will ever commit a crime. This is, of course, what Edward Snowden exposed. I think careerism is a kind of extremely powerful inducement to amorality.
Are you familiar with Philip Dick, the science writer?
No.
Science fiction writer. He's one of America's greatest science fiction writers. And he said that we live in a society where the media, the government, big corporations, political parties, and religious groups, in effect, manufacture spurious realities. And these pseudo-realities that come from Washington, Wall Street, and other major networks are very sophisticated. There's immense power and influence that goes into manipulating another person's beliefs, as if creating a new universe, such as the war on terror or the war on drugs. And these alternative realities, in turn, serve private interests rather than benefit the public. And since you've written a lot in the past on the variety of fabrications and illusions and the powers behind this web making, can you speculate where this is all leading us?
Well, it's something I talk about in Empire of Illusion. Totalitarian societies are image-based societies. They do spectacle very well. They effectively channel both emotional and intellectual energy into spectacle. I mean, sports is the, you know, these massive stadiums that are built in cities, including Yankee Stadium itself, at taxpayer expense. The way we now have entire cable, purportedly sports news channels that, you know, deal exclusively with sports gossip and trivia. The creation of, you know, this is Bernstein's The Image, the creation of pseudo-events that kind of masquerade as news. Following celebrity culture is perhaps a good example of that. But so much of news itself is manufactured in a totalitarian society. We see that with our politicians, where they will have a kind of gaggle of camera crews following them around, each day, and they will kind of act out a particular event that they want disseminated that evening to deliver a kind of message. So, and because the media is now completely captive to corporate power, it's become a very effective mechanism by which it shapes our perception of reality, and that, you know, again, is characteristic of a totalitarian society.
Would you go just a little further, please, Chris? Would you speak on the creation of a class society that lives in its own world, separated and removed from the day-to-day realities everyone else struggles with, and once someone gets past a certain threshold of power, they have a ticket to enter a new society, an
right.
exclusive club of other influential
That's power right.
brokers?
Well, I was in one last night. A friend of mine is quite a wealthy entrepreneur, invited me for dinner in New York. I won't name the club, but it was a private club. It had Al Sharpton was up there at this penthouse, and everybody had, there was a giant room, a humidor, where everybody had their boxes of their own cigars with a bronze plate with their name on it. This is the inner sanctum. This is a world that most of us never see. These are people who don't fly commercial airlines. They have no contact with working men and women unless that's their gardener or their chauffeur. I think there was a writer in New Yorker once who called it Richistan. And they are those elites that are able, through wealth and power, to retreat into what you would correctly call inner sanctums, but, you know, these kind of gated enclaves like Versailles or the Forbidden City. Now, that becomes very dangerous when those elites have total power, because they're utterly disconnected from the reality of the masses. And I think that we are seeing that within the United States, where those who have power no longer have any concept of what it is like to be a working man and woman in this country. They physically don't see the deterioration of the country. They're insulated from, you know, any contact with people other than their own group or their own class. They live in a separate reality, a separate world. And that's always true with corrupt, oligarchic elites that achieve total power. And it becomes really dangerous, because what they do is there are no self-imposed limits. They will exploit until finally there's an eruption or blowback, because they have no way to measure reality itself.
It's almost as if it's a cult of privilege, entitlement, and superiority. And once a person can enter this exclusive club, then even more power is at their fingertips to grasp. And as you mentioned, when a nation reaches this kind of division, the creation of a privileged class of power brokers who are almost immune to the law of the masses have certain freedoms unavailable to the rest of us. Could you, in the final comment, could you explain to us how we, the media, the public, are not paying attention to the idea that banks can break the law, corporations can break the law, agencies of government can break the law, and yet are not held accountable to what you and I would be absolutely brought into court on?
Yeah, and Matt Taibbi wrote a very good book on this called The Divide, where he spent a lot of time in the court system, and he juxtaposed what happens to poor people who are, you know, arrested and fined, harassed, for absurd offenses. You know, we saw with Eric Garner selling Lucy's, for instance, loose cigarettes, and yet, you know, with phalanxes of high-priced corporate lawyers, people who have committed egregious acts of fraud on Wall Street, are never held accountable. So what Taibbi points out, which I think is true, is that there's really a two-tiered legal system. There's one legal system for us, and there's another legal system that exists for the elites, where they write all their own legislation and all their own rules.
Chris, I appreciate you coming on and sharing your points of view. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary.
Now we're going to go over to our next guest. He is Joachim Hagopian. I hope I pronounced your last name correctly.
Yes, you have.
Thank you. And I gave the bio on you earlier in the program. And I want to pick up where Chris left off there. The recent rash of brutal police and law enforcement actions upon citizens, such as the choking death of Eric Garner, the shooting of Tamir Rice, and Darren Wilson's killing of Michael Brown, which ignited the first in demonstrations, disturbingly raises the question whether police are being trained to be brutal, petty tyrants, or do men and women who enroll in the police force at some point become conditioned to the idea that they can exert any form of aggressive power over citizens with little to no consequences? And this is a question no major media will address. And I feel, from a psychological perspective, there may be a growing relationship between police behavior and an entitled sense of authoritarianism that the job brings. And does this nature of law enforcement naturally attract authoritarian personalities? So, based upon your knowledge in several decades of clinical psychological practice and also confronting government institutions, as you did, and child services, which also have their own manner of exerting authority and power over families and children, would you speak on the nature of power in the context of holding a position of privilege outside of regular social norms and morality, and how does this contribute to the abuse of power that such positions of authority bring with it?
Sure. there's a parallel process where the federal government has exerted and invaded every aspect of our lives through absolute tyrannical power, whether it's through the media, whether it's through the education system. There's so many avenues to go through, and the militarization of the police into this security police state that we have under such high degrees of surveillance really is just an invasive control mechanism that is directed from the feds in Washington. There may not be, some explicit document. I hope that it's unveiled at some point, but certainly there has been a movement in this country, especially since 9/11, where the power is just so nakedly propagated on the people that are defenseless. We are, 8 times more, chances are we have 8 times greater that we will be killed by police than by an act of terror. And yet, if you believe the media and the aftermath of the horrible events in France, once again, it's like the whole psyche of 9/11 all over again. They're lurking behind every corner, and they're out to kill us and our freedom. What freedom? It's already been stripped since 9/11. They don't recognize. They do not practice the Constitution. We do not have due process in this country. There's a two-sided system here, one for the haves that are the 1%, and then there's the rest of us, 99%. And it pervades in every mechanism, be it the economics, be it education, be it, pretty much any aspect, science, health, every aspect. It's like this dichotomy between the elite system of elitists and then the rest of us.
It was the Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, who said, "It is not power that corrupts, but fear. The fear of losing power corrupts those who wield it, and fear of the scourge of power corrupts those who are subject to it." In that context, you have a unique background. And that background is that you had undergone military training in the past, and I'm sure you've witnessed the ways authoritarian power have extraordinarily influenced others and can force them to submit to authority. Soldiers and police officers, even the technocrats in large corporations like Monsanto and large banks, are expected, in fact, they are demanded to abide by inflexible conventions. Then this sense of an entitlement of authority trickles down to the platoon leaders, the middle managers and corporations, the cabinet members of the government and their assistants and bureaucrats, and even physicians under the strict codes of practicing only acceptable and professionally sanctioned medicine, which has killed more people than disease every year. Because I do this statistical analysis, death by medicine, that keeps bringing it up using their figures. Medicine itself, iatrogenesis, medically induced death and injury, does more killing than heart disease or cancer or diabetes or stroke. So in other words, everyone under the big authoritarian power brokers then become petite authoritarians. That's what I'll call it. But aren't those who submit to an authoritarian system also sacrificing their own higher values in order to be part of the system? And how does power, in your opinion, threaten critical thought and reinforces an indiscriminate attitude towards idealizing moral authorities?
Okay. Yeah, at West Point, there's an elitist institution that's very much honored in our nation. I saw firsthand power as it's trained and educated to those future leaders of America. And it's basically a dogmatic system of psychopathy where you basically sell your soul for the devil. you know, power equates to demonic kind of decisions where you are totally insensitive to the well-being of other people. It's a insulated system in which, you know, you're programmed and brainwashed to do everything to appear like you are one of them. You know, it's a psychopathic system that's run by psychopaths, and in that system, only other psychopaths are elevated, are promoted, are advanced. If you are a person of conscience and have the integrity to exercise that conscience through your actions, you will be ostracized. You will be rejected. You will not rise up in the system. So I found out very early on in my aborted military career that I was a warrior of peace and spirituality rather than the military kind that kills people. And I saw what it does. My roommate, I happened to be roommates of John Abizade, the general that was in charge of both Iraq and Afghanistan wars for 4 years, longer than any other individual. And at the same time, he was my roommate. Also, Carl Eikenberry, another general who became ambassador to Afghanistan a couple of years ago. And when we were beanheads or freshmen at West Point, you know, it was like us versus them. And, you know, I could see the humanness of them. But then I saw changes. As we rose up through the ranks into our upper class years, they bought into the system and they lived it and lived the lie for, you know, 30 something years and rose up through the system. And what I have found is those that rise up through the system, and it doesn't matter whether it's the military or politics or science or you know, education, law, all of them. To be part of the elitist system, you must give up your soul and your conscience. You are just a tool, basically, to make sure that the laws that are applicable for the masses are carried out. You're basically just another henchman, you know. And then there are the oligarchs, which I construe as the a lot of the old wealth Eastern families, you know, the Harvard, Yale, Princeton educated types that there's almost like it's definitely a caste system of the top elite that have held power in this nation for you know, centuries. And you know, we talk about the oligarchs, you know, with the Rothschilds in Europe. And there's been a system that's been around for several centuries where there's this banking cabal of Wall Street and the banks, central banks, and IMF and the World Bank. And you know, it's the inner sanctum of power. And they're the ones that call all the shots to the puppets who are the presidents, the CEOs of all the corporations, the generals. They're just the peons taking orders from the top. And the top is just basically, power is their game. That's they don't have any capacity for love. They might show a little bit of loyalty to their own kin. You know, it's a very much of a class system where the power is handed down from one generation to the next. But to actually have any sense of compassion and universal love for other human beings and life energy forms on this planet, there is none. And you cannot have any of that in order to be able to prosper in this very ugly, broken, morally decayed system that is unsustainable. And I think that more and more people are beginning to realize, even in America, where I think we are the last ones to know because of the tight media control being owned and operated by the oligarchs, I think that there's a discontent out there that's spreading. And I think that people are finally realizing this ugly game, this con game that's been put over on America and the whole entire world through American empire. I think people are really starting to get it. And I'm writing to those people. There are the people that have already gotten it and seek out the truth and all of that. Chris Hedges is a pioneer in this, and so are you, by the way. And then there's the people kind of on the edge that have this element of discontent in their life, and they know that the system is corrupt, and yet they are programmed to feel like there's nothing we can do about it. So let's tune in to Kim Kardashian's wardrobe malfunction, or, you know, the upcoming Super Bowl, or last night's National College Football Championship. It's a diversionary escape. But there's more and more people that are, I think, tuning in to, I mean, through basically the Internet. I mean, you know, with net neutrality, you know, up for grabs now, they're trying to take that away, so there's going to be limiting and censoring on the Internet. I think that's our best bet, is that's an avenue. You have to screen through it, but there are elements of truth out there in various websites, and I think that more and more people, particularly the younger generations, are turning to those alternative sources for their news and information and perceptions of the world rather than the mainstream news, which 3 out of 4 Americans already realize that that's total propaganda.
Joaquim, I have one important question for you.
Sure.
Because all of us have seen the consequences of petty politics, and even at the Pacifica Foundation, the petty politics and different stations, the boards, it polarizes, it destroys, and unless you're on the inside, you don't see it. Do you feel there's any truth to what the author John Steinbeck observed? He said, power does not corrupt, fear corrupts, because the fear of a loss of power.
Yes, I do believe that fear is at the root, I believe, of this unquenchable thirst for power. And once you're into that system where, you know, you're just, you know, everything is about attaining more power, more, you know, what we've seen in the events since 9/11 is that the more of absolute power is basically taking over the entire globe. And I think at the root of it, the source of it, is a fear of losing power. They know, the inner sanctum of oligarchs know that their system is morally decayed and corrupt, and that the jig is up, that the masses are learning, they're tuning in, and they're finding out that it's all been a con game that's stacked against the people without any kind of moral conscience or sense of ethics or morality whatsoever. And they know, I think what's going on right now is there's a shift of power of the inner sanctum of oligarchs going on right now as we speak in this world, where the Western oligarchs of Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan, Korea, South Korea, the Western oligarchs are losing power. And that's why we've seen an acceleration of these kind of terror events, you know, false flags like the one in Paris. We're seeing an acceleration of all this. We're seeing militarization where wars is more prevalent, and you know, we're knocking on the door of World War III with confrontations that could possibly go nuclear with Russia. They're really, underneath all of this surface events and turmoil, is a shift of power where the Western oligarchs, I believe, are losing their power to some extent. So it's that fear of loss of power that's really driving what we're seeing out there in the surface appearance of what goes on this earth. And I think that the what we're seeing also is that there's an Eastern oligarch system that's no more compassionate or, you know, endowed with any more conscience than the Western oligarchs.
I would certainly agree with that. Unfortunately, we are right now out of time. Joaquim, thank you very much for 25 years of outstanding work as a person who has been speaking truth to power, as a psychologist and as an advocate for those who have been abused in the child welfare system and education. We thank you for all your good work. His work can be found at globalresearch.com, and his West Point book is available at redredsea.net. And also, thank you very much, Chris Hedges, for your good work. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. We'll be right back.